So 70% of last year's biggest IPOs and over two-thirds of the Fortune 500 actually share the exact same legal address.
Right.
And the crazy thing is, it's not in Silicon Valley. It's not on Wall Street either. It is literally a single unassuming state that just happens to be the second smallest in the US. I'm talking about Delaware.
Yeah, it creates this incredible geographical mystery when you first look at the landscape of American
Oh,
business.
absolutely.
Because you picture the physical geography, of where the actual money changes hands, but the legal geography is almost entirely concentrated in just one place.
Yeah, and when I was pulling together the research for today, one number literally made me do a double take. So in 2025 alone, there were 334,461 business entities formed in Delaware.
Wow.
Hundreds of thousands in a single year.
That's massive.
It is wild. So today we're pulling from a huge stack of state tax codes, recent Chancery Court rulings, and standard venture capital term sheets to decode this whole phenomena. Because we designed this deep dive specifically for you, the listener, to completely demystify Delaware corporate law. We're going to strip away the myths. And spoiler alert, it is not some secret, shadowy tax haven.
Far from it, yeah.
Right? And we'll explain how Delaware actually functions as basically the default legal operating system for American capitalism.
That's a great way to put it. It functions exactly like an operating system.
Yes.
So the laws, the specialized courts, the capital markets, they're all constantly talking to each other. And together they form this interoperable network that gives founders and investors a really highly predictable framework for taking massive financial risks.
Okay, but before we figure out why the system is based in Delaware, we kind of need to talk about the structural architecture of these businesses.
Right, the container.
Exactly, because if you're starting a company, you can't just declare, I'm incorporating in Delaware and just walk away. You have to pick a legal container. Think about it like global shipping. If you're a local artisan selling handmade furniture across town, you can just throw your goods in the back of a pickup truck.
Sure.
In the corporate world, that pickup truck might be a simple LLC. But if you're trying to move thousands of tons of electronics across the ocean, you don't use a pickup truck.
No, you'd sink.
Right. You use a standardized 20-foot steel shipping container.
Because it doesn't matter what port you arrive at, the cranes, the cargo ships, the trains all over the world, they all know exactly how to pick up and move that specific steel box.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Boom.
Because in the venture-backed startup world, that globally recognized shipping container is the Delaware C Corp.
Yep, the gold standard.
But to understand why the market demands that specific container, we have to look at why the other options like completely break down when you try to scale. For example, why not use an S Corp? Because they are incredibly popular for small businesses.
They are very popular for small domestic businesses. But for a scalable startup, the S Corp structure breaks almost immediately
Right.
because an S Corp isn't actually a distinct entity type. It's really just a federal tax election you make with the IRS. And to keep that special tax status, you have to follow these brutal restrictions. Like, you are legally capped at 100 shareholders.
Which is nothing for a growing startup.
Exactly. And you can only issue one single class of stock.
Which means no special preferred stock for investors.
Precisely. And here's the absolute deal breaker for startups. Venture capital funds, which are typically structured as limited partnerships or LLCs themselves, are largely prohibited from being S Corp shareholders.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if a VC writes you a check and takes equity in your S Corp, you instantly violate IRS rules and lose your tax status. You literally cannot take institutional money.
Which naturally pushes people to look at the LLC. Now, a Delaware LLC is a fantastic vehicle for a lot of things. The research you looked at shows they're incredibly flexible because they're governed by a private contract and operating agreement that you just get to write yourself.
Right, totally customizable.
So if you're setting up a real estate holding company or a joint venture or a family office, the LLC is deeply powerful, but they come with a default pass-through tax status.
And this is where the mechanics of taxation clash with the mechanics of venture capital.
Yeah.
Because pass-through taxation means the LLC itself doesn't pay corporate income tax. Instead, every dollar of profit or loss or weird tax deduction flows directly through the company and lands right onto the personal tax returns of the individual owners.
Just imagine the paperwork nightmare there. Like, if a venture capital fund invests in your LLC and that VC fund has, say, 500 of its own limited partners,
Oh, yeah.
like, pension funds, university endowments, wealthy individuals. Your startup's tax complexity just passed through to 500 different tax returns.
It's a mess.
Everyone is just waiting on a K-1 tax form from your little startup just to file their own taxes.
It creates an administrative catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
Institutional investors refuse to deal with pass-through tax allocations, not to mention the complexities of granting profits interest mm-hmm. to employees in an LLC.
Right.
They just want clean, compartmentalized risk.
And that brings us back to our standardized shipping container, the Delaware C Corp, because it is a separate, distinct taxpayer. The tax stops at the corporate level.
Exactly.
But beyond just fixing the tax headache, it perfectly accommodates what we call the financing stack. Because when a startup raises capital, the founders, the investors, and the employees do not get the same type of equity.
No, they don't. And the C Corp is explicitly engineered to handle multiple competing classes of ownership without breaking. So the founders hold common stock. The venture capitalists, they demand preferred stock.
And that preferred stock comes with massive strings attached, like liquidation preferences, meaning, you know, if the company sells for a disappointing amount, the investors get their money back before the founders see a single dime.
Right.
They also get anti-dilution protections.
Yeah. And the employees get a standardized pool of stock options.
Mm-hmm.
What's fascinating here is that VCs don't force founders into a Delaware C Corp because they want to exploit some secret loophole.
Which is the big myth.
Right. They force it because it makes risk completely legible. If a firm is writing a $20 million check, they need the rules of the game to be universally understood. They need to know exactly how that preferred stock converts into common stock during an IPO and how their board voting rights function.
And there's also a massive federal tax incentive baked into this structure called QSBS, or Qualified Small Business Stock.
Right. Section 1202 of the IRS tax code. It is perhaps the single most powerful tax planning tool in the entire startup ecosystem.
The mechanics of QSBS are just wild. If you invest in a qualified small business and you hold that stock for 5 years, you can potentially pay zero federal capital gains tax when you eventually sell it.
Zero.
We are talking about wiping out taxes on millions of dollars of profit. But the IRS stipulates that to qualify for QSBS, the company must be a domestic C corporation. An LLC or an S corp simply does not qualify. So the container itself unlocks the tax break.
Exactly. So we have this standardized container.
Yeah.
But a container is pretty useless if you don't have a reliable port authority governing how it moves.
Right.
And that is where the legal infrastructure of Delaware comes into play, starting with their foundational code, the DGCL, or Delaware General Corporation Law.
Yeah. The DGCL is described as an enabling statute, which means it does not exist to micromanage a business. Instead, it provides this broad, highly customizable framework.
Right.
So a tiny software startup operating out of a garage and a massive multinational public company can both use the DGCL to architect their own specific governance through their bylaws and charters.
It fundamentally allocates authority. It establishes that the business and affairs of the corporation are managed by the board of directors. But then it gives corporate lawyers the specific tools to design complex equity structures, approve multi-billion dollar mergers, and shield directors from certain liabilities.
Okay, I have to pause and push back on something here.
Sure.
The entire selling point we just discussed is predictability, right? Investors want a system where the ground won't suddenly shift underneath them.
Yes.
But in the legal filings we reviewed, Delaware actually passed Senate Bill 21 as recently as August of 2025. And then the Delaware Supreme Court just issued a major ruling upholding those changes in February of 2026.
That's right.
And this legislation fundamentally changed the safe harbor procedures for conflict transactions, which is, you know, when a controlling stockholder or a board member has a personal financial interest in a deal.
Okay.
So if the foundational laws are undergoing these massive legislative and judicial overhauls in 2025 and 2026, doesn't that inherently destroy the predictability that investors are supposedly paying for?
Well, that is a very fair critique, but it requires looking at how legal predictability actually functions in reality.
Okay.
Because what Delaware offers is not a static, frozen set of rules written in the 1800s. The global economy evolves. Complex new transaction structures like SPACs or novel merger agreements,
yeah,
they emerge constantly.
Right. Business changes.
Exactly. If the law remained frozen, it would just become obsolete.
Yeah.
So Delaware provides what legal scholars call dynamic stability.
Meaning it adapts without breaking.
Yes. Think of it as a meticulously tested operating system update. When Delaware evolves the law, as they did with Senate Bill 21, it happens through a very deliberate process. the corporate bar, like the top corporate lawyers in the country, drafts the updates, the legislature passes them, and the courts immediately begin issuing deeply reasoned opinions on how to apply them.
Ah, I see.
The ecosystem tracks these changes in real time. It's an evolution, not a sudden chaotic system crash.
Okay, that makes sense. And when there is a dispute over how that operating system is functioning, you don't go to tech support, you go to the Delaware Court of Chancery, which is basically the crown jewel of the entire Delaware system.
Oh, absolutely. It is the institutional engine behind Delaware's dominance.
And it operates completely differently from a standard civil court. For one, there are no juries.
None.
Corporate cases are decided strictly by a chancellor and vice chancellors. These are highly specialized judges who handle complex equity and governance disputes day in and day out.
Mm.
If you're locked in a battle over venture capital anti-dilution provisions or like fiduciary breaches, you're not trying to explain those concepts to a jury of random citizens who have never even looked at a term sheet.
You are arguing in front of an expert. And because these judges don't have to summarize things for a jury, they write incredibly detailed, nuanced opinions. Over decades, this has created a remarkably deep map of case law.
Right.
And that map is the predictability premium. You are never guaranteed to win a lawsuit in Delaware, but your legal counsel can look at past chancery decisions and estimate with high accuracy exactly how the court will analyze your specific dispute.
And the framework the Chancery Court uses to analyze those disputes really centers on fiduciary duties. Directors and officers owe the corporation specific duties. The duty of care, the duty of loyalty, and good faith.
Exactly.
Like, are you making informed decisions? Are you putting the company's financial interests ahead of your own personal wallet? Are you avoiding intentional misconduct?
Which naturally leads to the most critical concept in American corporate law, which is the business judgment rule.
This is fascinating to me because if you're a startup founder, the idea of being personally sued by your investors for every mistake you make is just terrifying.
Right. But capitalism fundamentally requires risk-taking. If a court second-guessed every single business decision that resulted in a financial loss, nobody would ever launch a new product or enter a new market or try a novel strategy.
Nobody would want to be on a board.
Exactly. So the business judgment rule acts as a protective shield. It is the default posture of the Delaware courts.
So mechanically, how does that shield work? Say a startup's board authorizes a $50 million marketing campaign for a new software product. The product launches, the marketing completely fails to resonate, and the company just loses all $50 million. The investors are furious.
Okay, so under the business judgment rule, the court will presume that the board acted on an informed basis,
Mm-mm.
in good faith, and with the honest belief that the marketing campaign was in the best interest of the company.
So the board is safe?
Yes. Unless the furious investors can prove the board was self-dealing, like maybe they gave the $50 million contract to a marketing agency owned by the CEO's brother.
Oh, right.
Or they committed gross negligence by doing absolutely zero research. The court will not hold the directors personally liable for a bad business outcome. They protect the process, not the result.
Okay, so we have this highly specialized, predictable legal infrastructure that protects risk-taking.
Yeah.
Naturally, people look at this setup and assume Delaware must be a shadowy tax shelter.
Yeah.
They think that's the real reason the Fortune 500 is incorporated there. But here's where it gets really interesting. It's time to dismantle that myth, because registering in Delaware is actually quite expensive.
The concept of Delaware as a tax-free haven is probably the single most common misunderstanding among first-time founders.
Let me walk you through the panic-inducing rite of passage known as the Delaware Franchise Tax Notice.
Oh, yeah.
Every year, Delaware C Corp must pay their franchise taxes by March 1st. If you miss the deadline, you get hit with a $200 penalty plus 1.5% monthly interest. But the real shock comes from the math. Delaware uses two different methods to calculate what you owe. The default method they use on your first bill is the authorized shares method.
Which is super dangerous because startups authorize millions of shares.
Right. When you incorporate, your lawyer might authorize 10 million shares, so you have plenty of room to issue equity to future investors and employees over the next decade.
Standard practice.
But the authorized shares method calculates your tax based on that massive 10 million number. So a brand new startup with zero revenue will open their mail and see a tax bill for $80,000. It induces pure panic.
I have seen founders nearly shut down their companies on the spot over that notice.
Oh, I bet. But the mechanics of the tax code offer a back door. you simply switch the population to the assumed par value capital method. This method recalculates your tax burden by factoring in your total gross assets against your issued shares. So for an early stage startup with very few physical assets, recalculating with this method drops the tax bill from $80,000 down to the minimum of just $400.
Yeah, and it caps out at $200,000 for standard corporations or $250,000 for large corporate filers. But the fundamental takeaway here is that you are actively paying the state of Delaware thousands of dollars a year for the privilege of using their legal operating system.
And what if your business operations are physically located inside the state of Delaware? The state levies an 8.7% corporate income tax on you, so they are definitely collecting taxes.
Oh, absolutely.
But more importantly, incorporating in Delaware does not make you invisible to the state where you actually live and work.
Exactly. And this brings up the concept of foreign qualification, which acts essentially as a geographic toll booth.
Okay, let's trace the mechanics of this toll booth. Say you are a tech founder living in Los Angeles. You form your Delaware C Corp, thinking you've cleverly escaped California's high taxes. But the moment you rent a small office in Los Angeles or hire a local engineer, the California Franchise Tax Board considers you to be doing business within their borders.
Yeah, California doesn't care that your legal registration is in Delaware. Your physical footprint is in California.
Exactly. You are legally required to register as a foreign corporation doing business in California. And the moment you cross that compliance layer, California hits you with an $800 minimum franchise tax every single year, just for existing inside their state limits.
Yep.
You haven't avoided any local taxes. You have just multiplied your compliance burden. You now pay Delaware for your legal architecture and California for your physical operations.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it proves the core thesis. Companies do not flock to Delaware to avoid taxes, and they do not go there for total anonymity, because federal securities laws and banking KYC procedures still require strict disclosure of beneficial owners.
Right.
They go to Delaware for the network effect.
It's pure interoperability. The startup's lawyers draft Delaware documents because the venture capitalists demand them. The VCs demand them because the Wall Street underwriters who handle IPOs understand them. The entire financial ecosystem speaks one distinct language, and that language dramatically reduces the friction of moving hundreds of millions of dollars.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, if you are actively building a business or allocating capital? If Delaware is an expensive premium service that adds extra compliance layers and doesn't hide you from local tax authorities, when should you explicitly avoid Delaware?
Right. That's a great question.
If Delaware is charging a premium toll, surely there are budget alternatives trying to undercut them. Let's look at Wyoming.
Yeah, Wyoming is aggressively competing on cost. They are a highly attractive state for low-cost LLCs, personal holding companies, and private asset vehicles, because their annual report and license tax is famously cheap. It's just $60, or a fraction of a penny per dollar of assets located specifically in Wyoming. So if you are setting up a lean private LLC to hold some real estate, Wyoming is fantastic.
Okay.
But they do not have the century of dense, predictable chancery court case law required to standardize a venture-backed C-Corp.
Well, what if a founder isn't looking for a budget discount, but rather wants to tip the legal scales in their own favor? You see aggressive marketing campaigns for Nevada, pitching it as the ultimate haven for privacy and management protection.
Oh, yeah, the anti-Delaware.
Right. They boast about having no state corporate income tax and laws that fiercely protect founders from being sued.
Well, Nevada has leaned heavily into that founder-friendly branding.
Yep.
And for a closely held private business where the management wants maximum shielding, it is a viable option. However, institutional venture capitalists generally despise asymmetrical founder protection. Investors want the balanced, heavily tested predictability of Delaware's Chancery Court. They want a neutral referee, not a state that explicitly favors the home team.
Which makes sense. What if we ignore the specialized states and just look at where people actually live and work? New York and California have massive economies, but intense local costs. New York charges $125 incorporation fee right out of the gate, plus their complex Article 9A franchise tax, which taxes business capital or income. And we already discussed California's unavoidable $800 toll booth.
The practical rule of thumb here is really straightforward. If you were opening a neighborhood coffee shop in Brooklyn or a boutique consulting firm in San Diego, and you have absolutely zero intention of raising institutional venture capital, do not saddle yourself with the compliance burden of a Delaware C Corp.
Right. Keep it simple.
Exactly. An LLC formed in your home state is almost always the most efficient architectural choice.
But the landscape is shifting. We have to talk about the corporate migration to Texas. The economic gravity there is massive right now.
Texas is a powerhouse competitor. They have built a deeply business-friendly brand characterized by no personal income tax and no state corporate income tax.
They do utilize a franchise tax, but the mechanics are incredibly favorable for growing businesses. Based on the controller data for 2026 and 2027, Texas set their no-tax-due threshold at $2.65 million.
Wow.
Yeah. A Texas-based business can generate over $2.5 million in revenue before they even trigger the franchise tax obligation.
Which is a massive runway for an operating business. But notice the pattern. Even when these wildly successful Texas operating companies decide it's time to pursue a national IPO or take a mega round of funding from Silicon Valley, the underwriters and lead investors will frequently mandate that the Texas company convert into a Delaware C Corp before the deal closes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, the capital markets simply insist on their standardized container.
Well, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started with a geographical mystery and decoded the map of American capitalism. Choosing your corporate home is not a mundane administrative task. It is a fundamental architectural decision.
It really is.
Delaware is not a magic tax loophole. It is a premium, standardized legal infrastructure. When you pay those annual franchise fees, you are buying deep predictability, specialized expert courts, and instant interoperability with the global capital markets.
And that is the exact analytical lens you should apply to your own ventures or the companies you invest in. Ask yourself, are we paying for this heavy Delaware infrastructure because our growth model actually requires venture capital and IPO standardization, or did we just blindly copy the structural mold of the major tech giants because it felt official?
Yeah, don't just blindly copy them.
Exactly. You don't need the standardized shipping container if you're just making local deliveries.
Which brings us back to our opening mystery. If 70% of our major IPOs and the vast majority of our Fortune 500 companies are all running on the legal operating system of a single tiny state, it leaves you with a lingering question. Does that intense, rigid standardization actually free up founders' mental energy so they can focus entirely on true innovation? Or does it quietly force all modern businesses to conform to the exact same structural mold, subtly limiting how we even imagine a company can be built?
Yeah, it is the ultimate tension between market efficiency and structural imagination.
And it all traces back to a few unassuming blocks in Delaware. Until next time, keep diving deep.